It's not a good time to be a whistleblower.
You get fired, and in some cases you get prosecuted, and in other cases you even get prosecuted facing the death penalty or life in prison.
We'll hear from a 9/11 whistleblower who was one of Time's Women of the Year. She says secrets are damaging to democracy and our safety. I'm Susan Barnett, and this is 51%, The Women's Perspective. While the world watched, former national security contractor Edward Snowden raced around the world in an effort to find sanctuary after revealing what the U.S. government says were state secrets. He leaked details of mass surveillance by the U.S. and U.K., revelations that proved deeply embarrassing and only became more so as the U.S. demanded his return, only to be rebuffed by China and Russia. Amnesty International sided with Snowden, saying no one should be prosecuted for disclosing human rights violations. Meanwhile, veteran lawmakers Dianne Feinstein and Robert Menendez argued Snowden isn't a whistleblower. They call him a fugitive and a criminal. Feinstein argues Snowden should have stayed to face the consequences. Meanwhile, Bradley Manning, who provided classified documents on U.S. torture of terrorist suspects to WikiLeaks, could face the death penalty. And WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange remains holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, trying to evade extradition on sex crimes charges. In 2002, whistleblower Colleen Rowley was named a Time magazine Person of the Year. She was an FBI agent whose memo regarding fatal mistakes in the month leading up to the 9/11 attacks was leaked to the press. Rowley told me that the growing secrecy around U.S. actions is a threat to national security, leaving the U.S. open as a target of hatred around the world.
You had the major failures that caused or enabled 9/11 to occur, and this is not me saying this. This is the actual official investigations and inquiries, and there were about four of them, actually. They all said it was due to failure to share information between agencies, inside agencies, like in our case, it was just inside the FBI. It never even got outside the FBI. And then the third one, this is the key thing for listeners to recognize, with the public. Now, if you understand that 9/11 was in part enabled due to secrecy and failure to share information with the public. Now, that actually cuts across every official thing we're hearing right now, which is that national security requires this deep, vast, immense secrecy to protect you. And it's absolutely the opposite. And if there's one thing that I need to say over and over and over, secrecy is, you can certainly, there is maybe some small temporary need for secrecy in some cases on the part of government. There is this little bit of secrecy. With military moves, landing on D-Day is a good example. Of course, they couldn't tell the logistics of where the D-Day landing in Normandy was going to occur. So for that short period of time before the landing actually occurs, that is a justified need for secrecy. But it's gone, you know, that little bit of justified, it's so easy for people to be misled. It has gone just insane now. With the government collecting all of this information, now an individual has no privacy or very little privacy at all left as an individual. You're not allowed to, your banking records and your telephones and who you're in contact with and every single telephone call you make, et cetera. Things that are completely not relevant, and there's no reason at all for the government to be collecting this. In fact, it hampers and hurts the government's efforts to find terrorists by what they're doing, which is a massive collection. So individuals have none, but it's a paradox that the government now, that what they're doing, they can start wars, they can even support certain terrorist groups around the world. And of course, if the American public knew that our government was supporting terrorist groups, they would be like, what are we doing? I thought we were in the war against terrorists, and now you're arming this group, or you're letting some groups commit covert assassinations, etc. So So that immense secrecy on the part of the government is in complete contrast with what they're doing with the public. When this kind of balance gets so off the way it is now, I think, you know, and again, this is warning, and I'm not the only person trying to warn, this is really dangerous to democracy. It's dangerous to our form of government, and, of course, to the American public safety. This is actually a huge public safety risk right now with what's going on. And basically, you just have to recall that 9/11 actually occurred due to this excessive secrecy and turf battles between agencies, et cetera. When I wrote that memo, that's also a long story, but it got leaked. I did not do it, but it got out to Times, New York Times and Time Magazine, et cetera. Then the FBI, for a short period of time, you know, kind of talked about firing me. They classified after the fact that memo, even though there was nothing in it to be classified. Then, you know, eventually, four senators wrote letters to Ashcroft and the FBI director that I shouldn't be fired. And I was one of the Time Persons of the Year. And so I was probably one of the only whistleblowers to kind of survive. Because now, if you're a whistleblower, even about true fraud, waste, abuse, illegal actions, and or huge risk to public safety, you get fired. And in some cases, you get prosecuted. And in other cases, you even get prosecuted facing the death penalty or life in prison. If your secrets are ones that they really don't want told, that are real embarrassing, so that now they can even go after journalists who are the source of those stories. So it's not just the whistleblower, it's actually the journalists or the writers or the reporters, could even be a radio host. So they're treating them as if they are spies. And Edward Snowden, the recent NSA whistleblower, well, if you look at, I've written 2004, 2007, 2010, I wrote articles that said the same thing. I did not have the documents. I was long retired, and I didn't have the proof. But, of course, we knew to some extent because these other things were coming out. So we knew this was going on long before Snowden actually leaked the documents. So I've written about these issues, and I want people to really take action, and we're at a fork in the road. If we continue down this very dark side way that we're going, we are in just serious, serious trouble, and we've got to change. And the only way it's going to change is for a lot of people to complain, and certainly to do something, to call up your congressman, to write letters, to do all these things. We can't be apathetic any longer.
So, Colleen, are you saying we are returning to the Nixon-era days when if you are the president or you're acting in the president's name, the law doesn't apply to you?
That mentality has come back completely. So there are completely highly illegal orders that have been given beginning, like I said, a week after 9/11. And it goes everything from the worst probably are the kidnappings and torture that Bush did. Obama has morphed that slightly or changed it slightly, but it's only in an executive order. So it's out there for any other president to come along and just go right back to these most egregious picking up people anywhere in the world and torturing them. The thing that Obama's done might even be worse because he's got the kill list of putting people. So instead of capture, it's called capture or kill. He realized that capturing and putting people with indefinite detention on Guantanamo had all these problems and a public outcry where the rest of the world thinks it's terrible we're holding people without evidence. 86 are cleared innocent and we're still holding them, so that's a huge black eye for the U.S. Well, it's not just him. It's the advisors. It's that whole national security, surveillance, military-industrial complex group. They then it was already going on. Bush had already started drone assassination, but then Obama amplifies it. And in fact, what he does is he switches over to relying on the drone kill list. There's been some recent changes, slight changes on that. So these are just, you know, terrible things, but because they're all illegal, by the way, too. The drone policy, they constantly will say at the start, this is legal. You see, every time they're asked for a response, the first thing out of their mouth is this is legal. If you remember Bush, when he was asked about waterboarding, he said, we don't torture. The first thing he says, we don't torture. That very same day, they had people that they were waterboarding, that he went out in front of the microphone and said, we don't torture. He said, we always get a court order. Bush did this. We always get a court order. If we are going to monitor an American, we would get a court order. The same day he's saying that, they're listening in and vacuuming up Americans' telephone calls. And it's not, none of this is perfectly legal. It's all highly illegal.
And
but it gets normalized over time, and the public comes to accept it. And then when the public accepts some of these highly illegal things, as happened with the warrantless monitoring, it's very hard to, very, very hard now, even for some of the Congress people to were shocked to realize it was this bad. Now, what can they do about it? They voted for a law in 2008, the FISA Amendments Act, that gave immunity to the telecoms, et cetera, that actually said, yes, we can warrantlessly monitor. So it's going to require a massive populist public outcry and response to turn this around. And that's why I speak out and try to explain to people, because there's a lot of propaganda, even in the mainstream media, the thing with secrecy. Well, right now, I think it's more or less a majority of people in the country think secrecy is what we need to give us national security. You'll see all kinds of columnists and writers and editors of newspapers writing about the need for this governmental secrecy. It's just the opposite. The same thing with, of course, for a while, there's just been a popular movie, Zero Dark Thirty, showing that torture worked to find bin Laden. It wasn't true at all, but they show now 60% of Americans in polls favor the use of torture. So you get this kind of normalizing and desensitization of the public itself after years and years of this going on.
And I personally think that part of the issue is none of us see this impacting us personally.
If you understand pragmatically how this is affecting us, now if the Al-Qaeda, for instance, is going up because of the drone bombing, it has tripled now in Yemen, at least tripled, maybe quadrupled. So that those dangers come back as the Boston bombing, and there's been three or four major attempted terrorist attacks in the U.S. and a couple of successful ones. And if you think that that's going to get worse because now the polls in Pakistan show that, I don't know, it's like something like 10% of, it's like 90% of Pakistanis distrust and hate and fear the United States. If you understand that how this works and that now we are going to be the targets, you would probably then care a lot more about these policies being corrected.
Colleen Rowley is a former FBI agent, a whistleblower, and a lecturer on constitutional rights and ethics. Up next, trying to turn out the lights on abuses against animals. If you missed part of this show or want to share it with others, visit the 51% archives at WAMC.org. This week's show is number 1253. This year saw a healthy crop of anti-whistleblower bills, known as ag-gag bills, aimed at keeping animal rights activists from documenting conditions at factory farms and slaughterhouses. The Humane Society of the U.S. has come out strongly against these bills, and, not surprisingly, big ag corporations are strongly in favor. Eco Report focuses on one such bill in Indiana and why ag-gag laws may end up hurting you.
This is Dan Young for Eco Report. On April 27th, the Indiana legislative session ended without the passage of Senate Bill 373. This bill, called both an anti-whistleblower law and an ag-gag bill by its opponents, would have criminalized undercover investigations into abuse and mistreatment of animals in factory farms. Six states already have similar laws, and different ag-gag laws have been under consideration in 11 states so far this year. In early April, I spoke with civil liberties lawyer Lauren Reagan about these kinds of laws and their implications for environmental and animal rights activists and the general public. This is Dan Young for Eco Report. I am speaking on the phone with Lauren Reagan. She is the director and staff attorney for the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, Oregon, which for 15 years has been involved primarily in defending environmental and animal rights activists. Lauren, do you see ag gag laws being connected to the larger phenomenon that's been referred to as the Green Scare, where environmental and animal rights activists have been labeled as terrorists in both propaganda and law and prosecuted as terrorists?
Well, I do think that there are some unfortunate similarities. The ag-gag laws not only target animal protection activists, but, I mean, they are, you know, really directly targeting food safety advocates, employees, labor issues. They're a direct attack on free speech and, First Amendment rights in general. And I think the common nexus between these laws and the somewhat recent attacks on activism in general kind of boils down to corporations and profit. There is a lobby group called the American Legislative Exchange Council, and ALEC is the acronym, and they are really at the core of a lot of these issues that we're seeing. ALEC actually comes up with draft model legislation that they then basically sell to legislators. We'll put $10,000 in your back pocket if you go to your state legislative hall and try to get this law passed for us. And most of the laws that they're trying to get passed are eroding worker safety, are trying to reduce environmental protections. And the AETA, the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, as well as most of these ag-gag laws, all started off on the table of ALEC. And so ALEC's number one priority is to maximize the profits of its members. And those members include private prisons, pharmaceutical companies that use animals for research, as well as industries like cattle and chickens and all sorts of things like that. And I think that over the last 10 or 15 years, particularly with the increase of video and some of these methods of documenting animal cruelty, more and more people in the general population have begun to have sympathies for animal protection activists. And the industries see that as a direct attack on their profits. And what they have that animal rights activists don't have is tons and tons of money, and through that money, direct contact to legislators. And so they are literally legislating protections for their industries that they would not otherwise have in sort of this moral battle for public opinion. And so cases like the Green Scare, again, that is basically a slam job. People have used economic sabotage, including property damage and arson, forever in this country. And so in the post-9/11 environment, the industries and the government basically decided that they could use their control of mass media to spin a story that really wasn't factually accurate, that somehow economic sabotage by radical environmental activists that, never threatened a human life and never caused an injury or any harm to a living thing could somehow be elevated to this boogeyman word, terrorism. And the reason we called it the Green Scare was to hearken back to the Red Scare, from the 30s to the 50s, where it didn't really matter whether or not you were a communist. If the government labeled you as a communist, you got blacklisted, you lost your job, you couldn't find housing. There were all these stigma that became attached to this political belief that you were labeled. And, with the current version of quote-unquote eco-terrorist or, whatever word of the hour they're using, there's no way for these activists to challenge it. They don't have equal footing in the media. There's no court that lets you go in and say, look, I'm not a terrorist. So I would say that those, you know, those similarities are definitely at the heart of why all of a sudden, you know, these ag-gag laws are coming into the public domain. You know, they started back in the 1990s. And it's only now that people are really starting to recognize that not only is this making them less safe, you know, their food less safe or their community less safe, but it's also an incredible attack on the First Amendment. And we've seen a lot of those types of attacks lately, but, you know, whenever anyone loses a significant right, you know, we all lose a right. And people may think, well, I'm not an animal rights activist, so, you know, them having their speech repressed doesn't affect me. But those same types of guidelines and laws and rules, you know, can easily be turned and used on any population. And I think with ag-gag in particular, you know, animal rights activists have been uncovering these horrific acts of animal cruelty and food safety and employee violations. But some of the more unsung heroes of that type of exposure are just workers. You know, they're people who are working in the slaughterhouses. They are taking little videos or taking photographs with their cell phones, and they are taking that information and they're giving it to people who they think can do something with it to basically stop what they see as, you know, morally unjust or, you know, illegal or wrong. And right now, workers are not in a position to be gambling with their jobs. Unemployment is high. People need their income to support their families. We can't assume that workers are in a luxurious position to risk their livelihoods in order to expose these types of practices. And that's why organizations, you know, like HSUS, the Humane Society, or Mercy for Animals are serving a critically important role right now, because they allow those workers to continue earning an income at the same time as contributing toward, you know, stopping what is usually an illegal or cruel or horrific practice that they see in their workplace.
This is Dan Young for Eco Report. I've been speaking with Lauren Regan. She is the director and staff attorney for the Civil Liberties Defense Center in Eugene, Oregon. Black hole sun, won't you come wash me?
That's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our theme music is by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. If you'd like to hear this show again or visit the 51% archives, go to our website at wamc.org. If you'd like to connect with us on Facebook, you can find 51% there. And you can also email me at sbarnett@wamc.org. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another edition of 51%, The Women's Perspective.